BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Nuala McGovern and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Just to say that for rights reasons, the music in the original radio broadcast has been removed for this podcast. Hello and welcome to Woman's Hour. Well, a royal appointment for the celebrated composer and singer-songwriter Erolyn Wallen as Master of the King's Music. She is the second woman to hold that position. We're going to be speaking to Erolyn this hour. And among her many, many achievements, she wrote Spirit in Motion for the opening of London's 2012 Paralympics. It was a stunning performance. We're going to talk about that and many other things. But I do wonder what we'll see as the Paralympics opens in Paris tomorrow. We have the former Paralympic swimmer, she's now broadcaster, Rachel Latham, previewing what to expect and what to look forward to over the next couple of weeks. And we're also going to make time this hour for love. Shifters is a fabulous play about reviving first love as it redefines the rom-com. The writer, Benedict Lombé, is just the third British black woman to have a play staged in the West End. She is here with actor Heather Ajipong, and there is a lot to discuss. Plus, yesterday, did you catch our programme on sisters? I'm going to play you a little clip this hour. But I also wanted to hear your sister stories because I couldn't take them yesterday. So I want to know whether it's a close or perhaps a strange relationship. Maybe you never had a sister. Maybe you're grieving a sister that you lost. Or maybe you found sisterhood somewhere else other than family. You can text the programme. The number is 84844 on social media. We're at BBC Woman's Hour. Or you can email us through our website. For a WhatsApp message or a voice note, that number is 03700 100 444 on your sister stories. But let me begin with the news you may have heard this morning that after a six-year battle, more than 3,500 current and former workers at Next have won the final stage of their fight for equal pay. An employment tribunal said store staff, who are predominantly women, should not have been paid at lower rates than employees in warehouses, who are typically male. Earlier on the Today programme, we heard from Helen Scarsbrook. She had worked for Next for 20 years and responded to this news.
I still really don't believe it's happened. It's absolutely incredible. I've always believed in fairness, and it doesn't seem fair that years and years after the Equal Pay Act came in, when I was actually at school, that women were still earning less than men for similar roles. And I'm a pensioner now, and it's unbelievable that we've had to wait till now for someone to actually recognise that our role is as valuable. That's a similar role for a man.
Helen Scarsbrook there. Well, lawyers for the shop staff have described the judgment as hugely significant, and the amount of back pay owed could amount to more than £30 million. However, Next said it would appeal against the ruling. To discuss the ramifications of this case, I'm joined by BBC Business correspondent Emma Simpson in our studio. Hello, Emma.
Morning.
And also Kieran Dorker, who is an employment partner at Lee Day, who led the case on behalf of the women concerned. Good morning, Kieran.
Good morning.
Emma, let me begin with you. The background to this case, and also why has it taken so long?
It has been such a long road. I've been looking at this equal pay action for years. And I think the reason it's taken so long is because there were some big legal hurdles to overcome on the way. First of all, the store staff had to prove that their roles in store were comparable, first off, with the warehouse operatives behind the scenes in the distribution centres. Then, stage two, they had to prove that their work was of equal value. And that was a key moment. And then finally, an employment tribunal had to decide, well, what was the reason for this? Was there any other material defence other than sex discrimination? Why they were being paid less? Now, in a nutshell, Next argued, look, it was down to market forces. There's a bit of a bun fight for warehouse staff, and we had to pay a higher going rate to recruit and retain them. But the tribunal ruled that this wasn't enough of a defence, although it should be said that the tribunal didn't uphold any of the claims of direct discrimination, but on the key terms that these women were fighting for, they were upheld. But as you point out, it isn't over because Next are planning to appeal, partly because there are some important legal principles at stake, they say, because this is the first equal pay action of its kind at this scale in the private sector that's reached a final decision.
We mentioned predominantly women, of course, with this, and you talk about the indirect discrimination. How significant will it be, do you think, for other women that are employed in retail?
Well, it's not just the next case. There are five other cases involving Asda. In fact, Asda was the first case back in 2014 that launched Asda, Tesco, Sainsbury's, Morrisons and Co-op. They all have similar claims, winging their way, working their way through the stages. Now, of course, the arguments might be slightly different, but I think for the women, the successful claimants here, this will be encouraging news for the claimants in the other cases. So we can say that the other retailers will be watching this closely.
Is it always about the argument of warehouse versus the shop floor?
Well, in the case of the retailers, yes. This is the first case of its kind in the retail sector. And of course, you know, in the last few years, there has been an incredible competition for warehouse staff. But of course, national minimum wage levels have increased. And of course, there is a differing amount of sort of pay gaps. And each case is slightly different, but the principles are the same.
Let me turn to Ciarán. Who are some of the women who won at the tribunal? We heard a little of one, which was Helen, but tell me a little bit more about them.
The women are, you know, all ages. They're working mums, they're grandmas who are also taking care of their grandchildren, they're school leavers. There's a variety of people, but the thing that they have in common is that they need flexibility to work. They need to have maybe part-time contracts because they have other responsibilities. They need to be able to get to work relatively easily because they may not have access to their own transport to drive to, for example, a warehouse. So it is, but the majority of them are women and young people.
And I'm wondering also how you think this particular case will affect other cases that Emma was outlining there. I imagine your legal teams are probably representing other women in other parts of the retail sector, for example.
I mean, that's right, we are. LIDE is acting for 112,000 clients across the various retail companies that you've mentioned, including the large supermarkets. And this will be a really welcome news to them because as with the next women, all of them have been fighting these cases for years, with the Tesco case running for nearly 6 years, Asda for more than that. And these cases have been really hard fought by the retailers. And as Emma mentioned, there are various stages that they've had to go through, and we're all at various different parts of that litigation. And next was the furthest ahead. So it really is showing that these cases do have merit, and we were right to push on for equal pay for these women.
You know, I was struck by Helen, who was speaking this morning, saying, you know, with the equal pay law has been in place since 1984, since she was in school, she's now a pensioner. Why is it so difficult to bring them at least even to this point that Next has?
It's incredibly frustrating, you know, and we hear it from our clients, and we're having to explain to them why these cases take so long. And I think it gets increasingly harder to justify why these cases take so long. I mean, it's actually not 1984, it's 1970 that the Equal Pay Act came in. And we are really encouraged by the current government's interest in equal pay, with Rachel Reeves talking about closing the gender pay gap as being a priority for her. And we hope that the current government will look at what is going wrong with these equal pay cases. At the moment, every woman has to bring her claim as an individual claimant. And then we work hard behind the scenes to try and group them together and bring them as collective claims. But there isn't really a proper mechanism.
Is that what holds it up? Forgive me for stepping on you, Ciarán.
Yeah, it could possibly be that. But also the law is not easy to follow. The employment tribunals aren't well resourced. So there's a number of issues. And of course, the respondents and the defendants in these cases are fighting these cases hard, as we would expect them to do. But all of that means that these cases take far longer than they should be taking. So we hope that the government will be looking at how to resolve some of these problems that we're finding in the employment tribunal.
Let me turn back to you, Emma. Next have decided to appeal. What could the consequences be for them as a retailer?
a fairly hefty bill, as you mentioned, potentially around 30 million, because they would have to adjust the makeup, the back pay. And then potentially there's a question of equalising the salary and the round across the workforce. So obviously not for a retailer with the profits that Next make, it's a significant sum, but it's obviously a sum that they can handle. But they want to appeal it on various sort of legal principles. I think they're all too aware of the implications.
Let me read a little from the statement from Next. In a statement, they had said that this is the first equal pay group action in the private sector to reach a decision at tribunal level and raises a number of important points of legal principle. The firm emphasised that no cases alleging direct discrimination against female staff were upheld, and that the tribunal found there was no conscious or subconscious gender influence in the way the Next set pay rates. Is that something, Kieran, that you think they might use in the appeal?
The fact that there was no direct discrimination, I don't know what they're going to appeal. That's for them to appeal. And the fact that they say that there's been some important points of principle, I mean, the cases that were relied upon have been around for decades. So I don't think they're new points of principle. And frankly, all of these retailers should have had their houses in order a very long time ago. The writing's been on the wall for some time that these cases were going to succeed.
Also, I'd be curious with you, Kieran, whether you see this going wider than retail and supermarkets.
I mean, it is quite possible. I mean, wherever there is gender segregation, where women are concentrated in one area and men are concentrated in another, there is the possibility that there is unequal pay, and women's jobs historically have probably been paid less for various reasons. And that's probably been perpetuated over the decades and is likely to be an equal pay issue.
Emma, do you see rumblings of that at all? And I ask you because obviously you've been covering this particular type of case for years, as you mentioned. But when it comes to, for example, the care sector or hospitality or construction, they are segregated often by gender.
Yes, but it's you know, a hard fight to prove. And of course, in the retail industry, you've got some quite clear gender breakdowns. Most of the shop floor staff are women, and most of warehouse workers are men. And of course, it's maybe just worth throwing in, of course, don't forget Birmingham City Council had a huge equal pay battle, mm-hmm. which they lost. And of course, look at the financial pickle they're in now, because it was hugely costly. That was in the public sector. This one is in the private sector, which makes it a bit different also.
I want to thank BBC business correspondent Emma Simpson and also Kieran Dorker, who's employment partner at Lee Day, who led the case on behalf of the women concerned at Next. I was asking you for some of your messages about your sisters. Oh, and as I turn around, I see a lot of you have been in touch while I've been chatting to Emma and Kieran. Here's Angela. She says, my two sisters, I'm in the middle, have been my anchor throughout my life. They've kept me safe and made me laugh. I am so lucky. Here's another from Julie. My sister and I were estranged for more than a decade. Over the last 18 months or so, we have been messaging on WhatsApp, and Angie, bravely rang me to thank me for some flowers recently. We hope to build on this and hopefully meet up and bond. I just want her to know that she's made me so happy since she came back into my life. And she is truly a special person. We're both 60 plus. We don't want to waste any more time. Let's get one more. I have four sisters. I'm the eldest. We're very close in age. At different points in my life, I've been close with each of them in different ways. I even share my birthday with one of them, 4 years apart. We can have months when we don't see one another, but when we get together, we are close and all get on really well. I know my sisters would be there for me if I needed them. 84844. If you want to get your message in, we had our programme on sisters yesterday, but now the floodgates have opened if you want to tell us your story about your sister. Now, next month, I want to let you know, on Tuesday, the 10th of September, as the new school term in England gets underway, Woman's Hour will be coming live from the BBC Radio Theatre in London with a special edition to investigate how mothers are bridging the gaps in the special educational needs and disability system, that is the SEND system. More than 1.5 million children in England alone have special educational needs and disabilities. But mums tell us it's a broken system with constant and exhausting battles as families fight to get a suitable suitable education for their children. We're going to be joined by EastEnders actress Kelly Bright, whose son has autism spectrum disorder, ADHD and dyslexia. Also a 17-year-old campaigner, Kelly Nellist, who lost years of education due to her poor experience off the SEND system. And also we'll be joined by teachers, head teachers and special needs teaching assistants. We want to talk about what happens when your child with SEND does not get an appropriate school place, the quality of provision for those that do, and also what it feels like to be a mum who is trying to navigate that system. To get in contact, it's all the usual ways. Any of your questions that you have or maybe the experiences that you want to share, do include a line in your message to say that you are happy for us to keep your contact. That way we have more time to get back to as many of you as we can. That is Woman's Hour asking, is the SEND system working? And that is coming to you in September. Looking forward to speaking to you about that. I know it is close to many of your hearts. But now I want to talk to you about a play that's on in London at the moment. This is only the third play in the West End to be written by a black British woman. It's called Shifters. It's about two former childhood friends, Des and Dre. They are first loves whose relationship we see twist and turn over a decade. It's been a huge hit and fans include the musician Little Sims, presenter Maya Jama, the actor Idris Elba. They're all co-producers off the show. Des is played by Heather Ajipong, who joins me now, as does the playwright Benedict Lombe. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. This is very exciting.
I have to say, exciting for me. I loved that play. Aww. I loved it, loved it, loved it. From the moment I walked into the foyer, which we can talk about in the theatre, the energy is fizzing.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it feels like a shift in the West End, for sure.
Shift.
For sure.
I like it.
Yeah. I mean, there'll be so many puns right now. Let's just prepare the listeners. It definitely, it feels like a moment. We're seeing different kinds of people in that space, sort of different kinds of people owning that space as well. It feels great.
Well, why don't we start? And Bene, you go by, right? Benedict is their full name, but you go by Bene. No spoilers, but give our listeners a little idea of the plot of the play. I was saying love. I was throwing it out. I mean, it's love, love, love.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great starting point. It is love, love, love. It's feeling. It's the story of, as you say, these two childhood friends who were first loves and they haven't seen each other for 8 years. So the play begins at this sort of very moment of reunion. And the kind of the plot of the play is essentially the story of their relationship, right? Like we kind of see it play out a bit like a puzzle. What you think might have happened, like, might not have happened. And so it's all about the twists and turns and the sort of the surprises, the moments that we get to surprise the audience with. The real story of their relationship. And it's very it's kind of magical and dreamlike and surreal, but it's also sort of grounded and rooted in real things. And I often say it's a love story, but I always say it's a life story. It's the story of these two people's lives that you get to see play out.
Grounded in real things. I won't ask for any love secrets from either of you. But Heather, it's a two-person play. Wow. I mean, it is you and Dre, played by Toshin Cole, on the stage. We are following you both back and forth through memory and years, and you're young and you're older. How does it feel? I should also say that you are surrounded by the audience. They're on every side of you, which I felt I had you in my sights the whole time. I mean, I'm sure the other side of the audience did too. Tell us what it's like.
Oh, it's an absolute dream. So this sort of traverse experience, we had it in the bush and we really wanted to make sure that the audiences could see kind of from different perspectives. So Lynette Linton, our wonderful director, wanted to ensure that that was kept, that was throughout the West End transfer. But for me playing Des, it's just an absolute dream. I think Bene is like a once in a generation talent. She's writes characters in a really nuanced, complex way and talks about love in a real way, talking about like the baggage we bring into love and this need to be vulnerable and need to be seen. And also as like a black actress having a role like this, it's like an absolute dream come true. So I can't really believe that I'm doing this. And yeah, it just feels like such a, like a massive honour.
How would you describe the relationship between Des and Dre?
Oh, it's real deep love. And there's something about, there's a line Bene says of about, it's a powerful thing to be seen. And this idea of stripping away masks and pretenses, and they really see each other. And like, the show, of course, is about love and joy and beauty, but it's also about loss and grief and transformation and healing.
You know, but the audience goes on that with you. First, when I sat down, I have to say, everybody around me was singing these songs. That, you know, I have to put my hands up. I didn't know all these Congolese and Nigerian songs that obviously were massive hits. And, you know, I kind of had it by the end of the show. I kind of got in the groove with a few of them.
Did you Google any of them afterwards?
Do you know what? I was trying to figure out, particularly, we'll get into your Congolese background, okay, in a minute, but the music is a huge part of it throughout it.
Yeah.
And also you mentioned kind of that deep, complex, you know, loss or nostalgia, all those things. Mm. The audience very audibly responds to you.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Did you expect that?
A little bit. I think there is something that happens, I think, when you get black people in an audience who are finally seeing their stories reflected back to them. Mm-hmm. They're finally seeing their lives reflected back to them. They're finally seeing their cultures and their food and their music. And I think there is this sort of, you know, people think that a theatre audience is supposed to be a certain kind of way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think the audiences that we get kind of completely defy what that, you know, idea is, mm-hmm. because they are really open with how they feel. And I think what happens is they allow like traditional theatre goers to also express themselves.
Absolutely.
In that way, yeah. Right? Because yeah. there's this idea of like, if you have like an industry audience, they're not going to respond the way that our audiences respond.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is like, sure, like this idea of theatre etiquette.
Yeah.
But part of it is also because there aren't enough black and brown people in that audience who will respond in that way and allow you to go, oh my God, I feel shock. I feel surprise.
Yes.
I feel giddiness. I feel deep, deep, deep just love right now. And I want to express that. And I think this is the kind of play that allows for that expression, right?
Yes,
like
absolutely.
We create the space that allows for people to react that way.
But, you know, I gave that stat out just as a line. But I mean, there's so much behind it that you're only the third black British woman to have a play staged in the West End.
Mm.
How does that sit on your shoulders?
It sits very complicatedly, if that is even a word. I think, you know, there's the idea of this kind of being a real moment because of the truth of the fact that, you know, the third black British woman to have a play on in the West End is really special and something to be celebrated. And in the same breath that we celebrate it, we're also kind of going, this can't be the reality for very long. Like, let's use this moment to celebrate this moment, but also let's go, hang on a second, like, what are the other stories from black British women that we can have in this space? Because I think if Shift is saying anything, it's that we need more stories.
And I want to also say Natasha Gordon and Yasmin Joseph are the other two women, black British women, that went before you.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have said, Benedict, and I'd be curious for your thoughts on this as well, Heather, that you worry about an erasure of black women that is rarely acknowledged in that space of theatre, even by the black men who have those platforms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that and I want to be careful in how I say this, because I think what's really been really beautiful that we've all kind of celebrated is welcoming a lot of incredibly talented black men into this space. I think it's something that we all really celebrate.
Yeah.
And often when we talk about the successes of black theatre makers and black artists, a lot of the time it is black men and has been black men. And I think there is something about us being really specific in that moment while celebrating those black men, also going, where are the black women?
Absolutely.
Right?
Yep.
And I think when we talk about that specificity, which is one of the reasons that I think this play is really having the impact that it's having, is because we are being really specific in what we're saying. We're being really specific in the things that we are representing. But at the same time, we're going, these are all universal things. Like, we can connect with them as human beings, mm-hmm. but because we haven't had plays that showcase dark-skinned Black women as romantic leads,
that's it.
Because we haven't had plays that showcase specifically Congolese culture and Nigerian mm-hmm. culture, because we haven't had plays that really kind of look at these two Black British characters and all of their nuances and complexities, and also sort of say they are everybody. Mm. It feels really, really, really important that we're saying that we're being specific, and I think that really helps with us seeing ourselves in this space, and also ensuring that other people feel seen and held. So that's I think what we talk about when we talk about the erasure of Black women, and I feel like this play and this show is hopefully doing a little bit of work in rebalancing that.
Absolutely.
Would you say, Heather?
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Having a dark-skinned Black female lead feels like radical, actually. I think often there's more cases where you see kind of Black men in those situations. But me also being this idea of like beauty and desire, it's just wonderful. And you see the audience members, some young Black women just looking at me saying like, that could be me. Like, so I think, and there's something about when you see it, you believe it to be true. So I think Benet's doing a real radical thing of like shifting the canon in terms of when we talk about romantic leads.
I think it's also, you're obviously representing people of colour that are watching it, but I think you're also bringing people who are not of colour into a world that maybe they are not as familiar with, and it mm-hmm. opens doors and shifts.
Hey.
I have to tell her about, because I know we have the Congolese Nigerian diaspora, but you know, shift in Ireland, what it would have been when I was growing up.
What was that?
It meant to kiss somebody.
No.
Yeah.
No way.
To shift somebody, which I thought was quite fun as well.
There's a bit of that in the play.
There is a little bit of that, maybe quite a lot of that in the play, which the audience are really into as well. Heather, but I want to turn to you as an artist as well. You also focus on mental health, and I'm just thinking about some of these challenges we're talking about, like the erasure of Black women or what it might be. Mm-hmm. But tell me a little bit about, number one, how you find the time, but also how you intersect that with your art, trying to help people with issues of mental health.
Yeah, I'm really interested in stories around vulnerability and making the invisible visible. And sometimes with mental health, you can't see anything. There's no... it's all happening internally. Yes. So I'm really interested in stories about being seen, opening up, showing vulnerability. So within my visual artwork and my acting, I'm always interested in those stories about creating visual images of Black women being vulnerable and fragile, and it kind of exploring their different versions of themselves. So I use myself. All of my work is self-portraiture, or in my acting, it's the characters I choose.
And of course, there's a lot about art and portraiture in Shifters as well. The Fugitive.
Yes.
I'm just going to have to go and see the play.
You have definitely seen this play.
Here's one other part, though, that kind of maybe also refers back, Heather, to a little bit of that vulnerability you're talking about, which is a theme in the play. And it's the topic of adultification. We've covered it on the programme before, but it's when children are treated as if they're older than they actually are. Mm. And it can be something that Black girls are particularly likely to experience. What about that storyline on the topic, Benet?
It felt really important. Felt really, really important to showcase that as part of a bigger narrative, as part of the narrative of just human beings being alive and getting to experience love, and that being something that you experience, but you're not defined by. Mm-hmm. I think, and I think, so many Black women, but also Black men, right? Like, have kind of expressed how important that specific storyline was for them to see in a love story, I think. Because I think sometimes when you talk about the adultification of black girls, it becomes this kind of like sort of big political debate. And I was thinking about that. I was thinking about the story of Child Q from a couple of years ago. I was thinking about so many stories that we've seen like this, and how we humanize that. And it felt to me like if we're telling a love story and we're telling a story of two people who come with all of this baggage and these experiences and learn to kind of like peel away those layers and really truly see each other and love each other in spite of and because of all of the things that they've experienced, it felt really important to portray something like that and also say you are absolutely deserving of love.
There is something about sometimes with black girls, there is a they're seen as not being innocent. I think there's a lot of stats that actually research about this. And I think because of that, sometimes this idea of like black women being strong or independent, it's a survival tool. But what's really beautiful in Shifters is that Dre sees the masks that Des puts on, these needs to feel survived, to feel protected. Because if you're not seeing as innocent as a child, you don't feel safe. You don't feel like you're protected. But Des just sees her and says, you're worthy of being held and being supported. And I think that's what really gets audiences when we see, I can see what you're trying to do. Yeah. You're trying to defend yourself and look after yourself. But don't worry, I'm here too, which feels great.
Yeah.
Shifters is at the Duke of York Theatre in London until the 12th of October. You will see Heather Adjipong along with Toshin Cole, and the play's writer is Benedict Lombe. As we were saying, the third black British writer on the West End. I expect to see a lot more. Thank you very much for coming into it.
Thank you so much
Thank
for having
you.
Us.
Now, back to yesterday. We had a special Bank Holiday Monday programme. It was all about sisters. It included a chat. Yes, it did. I was very brave about this with my own sisters, Vera and Eileen. Here's a taster.
I'm going to put you on the spot, Vera. What word would you use to describe me as a sister?
I couldn't give you a word, but you definitely march to your own drum. What would that word be?
Independent?
Independent, definitely. You liked to control the situation.
And
you would get out of things if you didn't like doing something. You'd get out of it.
I'll put my hand up to that.
By hook or by crook. Yeah, there's a few examples I could give you.
We won't go that far, but I was slightly infuriating. I can understand that. Eileen, I'll throw it over to you.
Wild isn't the right word, but it would probably have explained you at your teenage years without getting into anything too much.
Too specific. Wild, I'll take it. Wild and independent.
You were well able to chat to anybody, which we can see turned out in your favour.
McGovern Sisters there. You can catch up with all our different sister-themed conversations by going to BBC Sounds for the episode from Monday the 26th of August. You know, some define, it comes up in the programme, the different types of sister relationships as best friends, rivals, caretaker and protected, that's one type, estranged or indifferent. We are taking your calls this morning, 84844 on social media at BBC Women's Hour. Email us through our website. I do have a full board of calls here. Here's one that I got a message from my BBC colleague, Tina Ritchie. Having four girls close together, four under five, wow, was the greatest coincidence of my life. My girls have a phrase, sisters by blood, best friends by choice. They have had those initials, BFBC, tattooed on. Sometimes, of course, they are not best friends, but when the chips are down, it's the sisters they turn to. It's a club. I sometimes feel sorry for the boys that pass through our lives. Getting through the sister test is a tough one. It is indeed. I think I might have said calls coming in. No, texts are coming in. Here's one. Hi, Nuala. The moment you started chatting with your sisters, I knew you were the middle daughter. Independent and wild, sealed it. Us middle of three girls need to stick together. Listen, Billy Connolly, who I'm such a fan of, he always wants to be windswept and interesting. So I'll take independent and wild. It's not exactly windswept and interesting, but hey. Here's another. I'm blessed with four sisters. They've always been there in their own different ways at different times. We know we have each other's backs, particularly in times of loss or illness, but also in times of joy and laughter. We've lost both parents, our dearest brother and one of our partners in the last two decades. And that's when you know the privilege of growing up with the fierce love and support of sisters. Keep them coming. 84844. Well, tomorrow, all eyes shift, use the not word throughout the programme now, shift back to Paris as the Paralympic Games get underway. The opening ceremony is tomorrow night, and over the next couple of weeks, Team GB will try to emulate the success seen at the Olympic Games earlier this summer. We've already heard from one female para-athlete here on Women's Hour. That was the archer, Jodie Grinham. You can catch up with that interview on BBC Sounds. You'll spot her pretty easily. She's got rainbow-coloured hair. She also has a pregnancy bump of 7 months. And we were wondering, what other women should we be looking out for? Well, with her preview of the Games, I am joined by Rachel Latham. She was a swimmer, you might remember, competing at the Beijing Paralympic Games. She's covered all subsequent Games since then as a broadcaster. And this time fronting More Four's Daily Breakfast Show, which kicks off on Thursday. You'll be used to the early mornings then, Rachel. Good morning.
Good morning. Go on.
No, you go ahead. Forgive me.
No, I was going to say, absolutely, those early mornings in the swimming pool are basically everything I think about when I think back to my training for the Paralympics. And now I'm thrown back in at the deep end at the breakfast show this week. So it's something I'm used to, but also something that feels comfortable.
That's great. Well, how exciting. I mean, the Paralympic Games, always so joyful. Shall we go through some of the women that we should be taking or keeping an eye out for, should I say? I'll begin with Dame Sarah Story, who is still there churning it out and representing the mothers, Manny would say, for sticking with the sport.
Yeah, so to give you some background on Sarah, I mean, she's Britain's most successful Paralympian. She's won 17 gold medals in the swimming pool and cycling over 8 games. She's 46 years old. She's a force of nature. I mean, I've known Sarah for over 20 years, and she's been a role model of mine in so many ways. I mean, just looking back to as a child for me, learning to race, a teenager, learning to juggle sport and alcohol, when she was talking about how, you know, you get dragged into that and you're really wanting to, sorry, not juggle sport and alcohol, juggle that whole of sport and school, and you get dragged into those teenage years and all you want to do is concentrate on sport, and you've been pulled away. And she really helped with how to deal with that. And as an athlete performing on the world stage, and still now seeing her juggle motherhood whilst achieving her own personal goals. I mean, one thing that stuck with me that Sarah said, to be the best, you have to be somewhat selfish, mm-hmm. which is funny, as it's an attribute that most of us mere mortals, we aspire to be nothing but selfish. But for an athlete, it's true. You know, Sarah will always make time to support the next generation, and her two children are her everything. But when it comes to the Paralympic Games out there in Paris, winning gold will be the only thing on her mind. Her mentality is why she has remained the world's best for so long. I mean, I can't think of any athlete who has won medals at 9 consecutive summer games, but that's what Sarah's aiming for in Paris. And she's going to be racing in the cycling time trial and the road race. So we'll be watching for those medals.
It's such an interesting word, isn't it? Selfish. It's always got these negative connotations, but selfless can be a bit martyrdom as well sometimes. And, you know, that's not going to work, I guess, if you want to win gold, as Sarah's going for. Can I speak about the swimmer Ellie Challis, who I was reading about in the papers today? She was saying she was inspired by a kids programme about a dolphin with a prosthetic tail. We should be watching out for Ellie as well.
Yes. Yeah, so for anyone who doesn't know about Ellie, she is a British Paralympic swimmer. She was Great Britain's youngest Paralympic Games medalist in Tokyo, where she got a silver. So at 16 months old, she contracted meningitis, which resulted in them amputating all 4 of her limbs. She was inspired to get into swimming when she was 8, after learning about the dolphin you're talking about named Winter, whose tail was amputated after getting caught in a crab trap. It's funny what things can inspire you mm-hmm, to get into yeah. sport. She's continued to dominate in her classification, which is an S3. So in swimming at the Paralympics, your classification for physical disabilities go from 1 to 10. 1 is the most severe and 10 is the least severe. And she is a 3. She's a very high level of impairment. But since Tokyo, she's become the European and world champion. So she's going to be pushing for Paralympic champion to add to that collection next week.
So definitely one to watch. Also, the women's triathlon is a place that some are hoping for medals for Team GB. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think one of the races I'm most excited for in the triathlon is Claire Cashmore on Lauren Steadman. So these two were students together at Kelly College, so a boarding school down in Devon. They started as swimmers. So I have a good relationship with both of them, but they've now transitioned into triathlon. They were both on the podium in Tokyo. So Lauren took the gold in Tokyo at the last games and Claire Cashmore took the bronze. Same again at the recent World Championships. But it isn't just going to be about these two. So right there in the mix is USA's rival, Grace Norman. She's continuously been in the on the podium with these women, I'd say for nearly a decade now. And you might think, okay, well, Cashmore and Steadman, they're going to be working together as GB athletes. But since Tokyo, Lauren was actually a bridesmaid for USA's Grace Norman, and they frequently train together abroad. So as much as Claire and Lauren know each other, Lauren and Grace are very good friends. So these three are just going to be battling it out. And honestly, they have such a level of respect for each other from being in the world of Paralympics for so long that, you know, they all want each other to do well, but equally, they all want to win. And on the day, the gold could go to anybody, Great Britain's Claire Cashmore, Lauren Steadman, or USA's Grace Norman. And really, when you line up in a Paralympic final, all the hard work has been done. The next part is purely mentality. It's just who believes they can win. I mean, at the Olympics, we saw Alex Yee. He believed he could win, and that dramatic finish for him to take the gold was exactly how I think this race will go in Paris for the women's triathlon. They're in the classification PTS5, and I think that race between Great Britain's Claire Cashmore and Lauren Steadman will be equally as exciting as what we saw at the Olympics with Alex Yee.
We do love a little bit of rivalry as well. It's great to watch, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And I guess it pushes people in certain ways as well. Okay, let's go to a few more. Track and field.
So track and field, I mean, we all love watching people race on the track, but I think we should discuss Holly Arnold's javelin. I think it's important because she openly talks a lot about mental health. Mm-hmm. So background on her, this is her fifth Paralympic Games. I mean, when you go to your first Paralympic Games at age 14, I mean, you're pretty much destined for a handful of Paralympic Games fun. She is currently the world champion in the javelin in her discipline, but she's not had a continuous wave of success like some of the athletes we've been talking about so far. She picked up her first medal at her third game. So it wasn't until she went to Rio in 2016 that she won a medal. And that was a gold. But then to her disappointment, she finished bronze in Tokyo in 2021. And I was out in Paris at the World Championships last year, and I was chatting to Holly about that journey of an athlete of starting a game so young and chasing the Paralympic dream and it finally coming and then taking a backward step. And she was very open about how she struggled with the mental health and that all of a sudden when the pressure was on her, because once she'd been to a few games and had won a medal, not that many people were talking about her. And then all of a sudden she became the Paralympic champion in Rio. Everyone is looking at her to repeat that success. And she said she had never learned how to deal with being that top of the game and everyone looking at her. And she's basically spent the last 3 years since the Tokyo 2021 games, where she's got herself back on top and she's learned how to deal with the pressure of the games and how to turn those nerves and excitement into a positive mental attitude. She won the gold at the World Championships at the same stadium that she's going to be competing in. So that was the Stade de France. And she goes again this Friday and she's going to be hoping to kind of claw back that Paralympic title that she had from 8 years ago.
And after going through all of that. But, you know, isn't that it? Whether it's the Olympics or the Paralympics, maybe even to a greater extent, Rachel, that it's the personal stories. It's these people that are putting themselves literally on the line. And I think with Lizzie Jordan, let's talk about her, because she also had this traumatic event that happened in her life that has now led her to the Paralympics?
Yes. Yeah, so unlike all the other athletes we've spoken about, Lizzie Jordan's going to be making her Paralympic debut. So she's blind and she'll be competing in the velodrome and on the road with her pilot, Danny Kahn. As a person with a disability, I get that a lot of people don't think they can relate to disability, but how Lizzie lost her eyesight could happen to anyone. So I'm going to take you back to 2017. She was 19 years old and she woke up after 2 months in a coma blind. And basically she'd contracted E. coli from a takeaway that she picked up from a student night out. So she just went out on a night out with a friend while at university, picked up a takeaway on the way home, then had a very unusual reaction to that food poisoning. And when she woke up, she was blind. When I spoke to her last year about her story, she said, well, coming to terms with being blind, and especially at that age, I mean, 19 years old, and going from thinking, I know how my life is probably going to look like and what you're aiming to do and what you want it to become, to then being blind, she thought she could either give up or she could try and achieve something that she never would have achieved before losing her sight. You know, disability is one of the few minority groups that anyone can join at any time. You know, you won't wake up tomorrow a different race. It's unlikely your sexual orientation will change, but anyone can acquire disability. And this young woman, Lizzie Jordan, she's taken a shocking, life-changing event and worked hard to turn it into a positive. And earlier this year, Lizzie and her pilot, Danny Kahn, they became world champions in their first track event together. And they're going to be wanting more medal success at their first Paralympics together.
We shall be watching the velodrome. We will also be watching you, Rachel Latham. And I want to thank you for coming on, previewing the games for us, the Paralympic Games. Channel 4 will be showing them in the UK. And you can keep up with key events on BBC Radio 5 Live and across the BBC. It's going to be a great couple of weeks. Let me turn next to the composer and singer-songwriter, Erilyn Wallen. She has been appointed Master of the King's Music by King Charles. The position has existed since the 17th century and is awarded to musicians who have added to the musical life of the nation. What a wonderful thing to achieve. Erilyn's work is some of the most performed among living composers. It includes 22 operas. She's written pieces for the Golden and Diamond Jubilees of the late Queen Elizabeth II and for the opening of the London Paralympics that was back in 2012, as you may remember. Wallen is only the second woman to hold the post, following on from Dame Judith Weir, who was appointed in 2014. Erilyn, welcome to Woman's Hour.
Hello, it's a delight to be here.
And congratulations on your appointment. How did you find out? How are you feeling now?
It's still sinking in, but the overwhelming messages of sort of support and love for my colleagues and further fields have been really amazing. It's been wonderful.
You know, I was just speaking with a former Paralympian athlete about the Paralympics opening in Paris, and it made me think of London Paralympics, the opening ceremony in 2012. I was lucky enough to be there. And I mean, I think I cried through the whole thing, if I'm completely honest. It was so moving from beginning to end, not least part of your work that was performed there. Erilyn Wallen, Spirit in Motion with Denise Lee and the London Symphony Orchestra. And I will get to your new position in just a moment. But how do you go about creating something like for the Paralympics, for example?
First of all, I start, in that case, it was really... I had to really think about what it would feel like to be in the stadium without actually having gone there, and also to think about what music you could write that could go to 1 billion people simultaneously. What would that music be? So I've just felt the tone of it. I just had to get the feeling and atmosphere correct. And then I started writing because I wrote the words and the music. And it's a bit like making a tapestry or doing a jigsaw puzzle. You get bits here, bits there. But I would stress that composing is really a craft. You start with inspiration and then you work at a piece over time till all the joins fit and the whole thing works seamlessly.
And do you know when it's finished?
In a way, a piece is never completely finished. I've just been travelling around with a violin concerto. It's had 9 performances, and at every rehearsal we think, oh, should we try this? Should we try that? But yes, you do know there's a feeling, and usually it does involve somebody screaming for for the score because there's the performance date coming up. But yes, you feel this sort of clicking happen. You think, yeah, this is it now.
So with the master of the King's music, that role often composes pieces for royal occasions. You've done that in the past already at the Golden and Diamond Jubilees, as I mentioned. Is that part of the work that most excites you? Or what is it, really? Because it has no set duties, this role. It's honorary.
I know. And I really love writing for live occasions. Mm-hmm. I've worked a lot in, you know, doing public commissions. But I actually feel that this role is less about my career than me championing music and music making for all to sort of really, really lobby for sort of education I had, which at the beginning was free. In other words, access to music and music making to young children from a young age, and for that to happen on a daily basis, as it always used to, which is why United Kingdom has so many talented musicians, composers, you know, conductors. It's because we, you know, this bit like an athlete, the training to be a musician starts very young.
And with the role, it is for people who have added to the musical life of the nation. I just love that line. But you want to add more, it sounds like, to the musical life of the nation through younger people getting into it and seeing that as a way of life in whatever mode that might take. But how would you do that, do you think? Is it the schools? You mentioned yourself, your own path that you started young. It was in Tottenham, right, in London, and you had, there was free music lessons at that point.
Yes, and we had this most wonderful music teacher that taught us. We were all 9 years old, and she taught us all to read and write music, whether somebody was specialising in an instrument or not. I wrote music for that class. But what I loved about it was just so natural. And, you know, my life as a composer, people are often saying to me, oh, you know, how difficult can it be? And they think that it's all about wafting around in a room waiting for inspiration. And actually, I've always thought of composing as serving music and serving, you know, the community I'm writing for. In a sense, a lot of the work I'll be doing as Master of the King's Music, it takes me a while to get used to that title, is what I've always done all my life, which is to encourage young people coming up to really spread the word and enthusiasm about what composing is, and that actually anybody can take part, but also to promote the idea that music is for everyone, you know, whether it's playing a tambourine or singing in a choir, picking up an instrument, learning, you know, later on in life. This is for everyone.
That's so interesting, later in life as well. So not just through those children. You are, I mentioned, the second woman to be appointed Master of the King's Music, also the first person of colour. I was curious who your role models were.
Who were they? I have to say they would have been Bach and Chopin, and people who actually were long deceased. As a child, what it was is that I heard this music in a ballet class, and I was just mesmerised by it. And also, as I say, we had a teacher that was always playing this orchestral music, and I just loved the drama of it. So I wasn't thinking in terms of role models, as somebody who was living I could, you know, emulate. It was more, I was so keen to get to how this music was put together. And without knowing it, I was making up my own music, you know, in a very humble way. But composing really did grip me. I was always thinking about how the sounds you imagined, how it was that you could get these out into the world.
But I think many would think of composing as something that is out of reach for them. You know, that it's something so lofty, that it's something that can't be achieved. What would you say?
I'd say that is probably the fault of the people who write about music. In other words, they take so much for granted. But when I'm composing, actually, I think about the composers that have gone before me. And I know they would have been sitting sort of unwashed, undressed, under pressure, thinking, oh, my God, here's an E flat. What note follows that? It's a struggle, but it's very, composing really is a craft. And I have taught The other day, some children were staying here and they were saying, oh, we really like this house. So I said to them, OK, go and write a song about the house. Do you know, they came back in 1 minute, not with just a song and a dance. So children do it all the time. It's just making up sounds.
But in a very particular way, when it comes to Erilyn Wallen, I have to say. But I do love that. For anyone, for advice, women now who want to be composers, what would you say just in our last few seconds?
I would say just do it. Think, put the music first and just explore.
Lovely words from Erilyn Wallen. And thank you so much for joining us. And congratulations on being appointed Master of the King's Music by King Charles. Tomorrow, we'll be speaking to the actors Susan Wakumba and Belle Powley about their play, The Real Thing. It encourages its audience to question why we fall in love. Also, a text. I'm the youngest of six sisters and eight brothers. We are mutually supportive of one another. We have a laugh and we also cry together. We shout to be heard above one another and our noisy brothers. And as we have grown older, I am now 60, we have become even closer. I cannot imagine life without my older, bossy, lovely sisters. I'll see you tomorrow at 10. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
Nature Bang.
Hello.
Hello.
And welcome to Nature Bang.
I'm Becky Ripley.
I'm Emily Knight.
And in this series from BBC Radio 4, we look to the natural world to answer some of life's big questions.
Like, how can a brainless slime mold help us solve complex mapping problems?
And what can an octopus teach us about the relationship between mind and body?
It really stretches your understanding of consciousness.
With the help of evolutionary biologists.
I'm actually always very comfortable comparing us to other species.
Philosophers.
You never really know what it could be like to be another creature.
And spongeologists. Is that your job title? Are you a spongeologist?
Well, I am in certain spheres.
It's science meets storytelling.
With a philosophical twist.
It really gets to the heart of free will and what it means to be you.
So if you want to find out more about yourself,
via cockatoos that dance, frogs that freeze, and single-cell amoebas that design border policies,
subscribe to Nature Bang. From BBC Radio 4, available on BBC Sounds. Bang.